This is Guildcast, episode 22, for April 1st, 2006. Just spamming the details. Just spamming the details. Just spamming the details. Because you won't like it. Can you see me dreaming all the time? Hey everybody, welcome back to Guildcast. I'm your host, Sean, and since last week's episode was all about our opinions on factions and the preview weekend, this episode will be more about facts of the upcoming Chapter 2. The biggest difference also being that Lady Sinea will not be joining me in this episode, but I will be going over some aspects of the new game mechanics, such as how alliances work and what the new classes will be good for, as well as some of the storyline history for Cantha. Some of this I've said before, or you may already know, but it can be considered a review on the more minor points with some elaboration on the points I've never really went over before. First, though, I wanted to talk about an interesting glitch that was discovered during the preview weekend. Turns out, if you made a new character in the original Prophecies, you could make it so that they had a full skill bar of high-level factions, skills, and spells, including elites in some cases. Now, I only mention this now because it's been fixed, but this is how it was done. Okay, you create a new character, you select role-playing character, then select factions. Next, you select your profession, then click back to go back to the previous screen, and this time select prophecies. Then you continue on with the creation process like normal. Your new pre-searing character will have all the same skills and spells that a new level 20 factions preview character would have for that class. But like I said, this was fixed, and it wouldn't even work now anyway with the preview weekend over. I think bugs like this were to be expected, though, because of the weekend being like a beta test of sorts. But I still find myself fascinated by glitches and bugs like this. And not so much to exploit them, but just because of their hidden or their secret nature, you know. Also, on Wednesday, March 29th, or Thursday the 30th, whatever, depending on where you live, there was a server shutdown for a few hours so that ANET could fix a few network problems. But curiously enough, after this downtime, there was an update. And according to the Guild Wars website at guildwars.com, they have the following announcement. Attention, fellow citizens of Tyria. You have no doubt gazed with sorrow upon the scores of refugees displaced by the terrible conflict raging in the southern lands of Cantha. Were it not for the noble efforts of hired heroes, these poor souls would be spending another cold night in filthy gutters. Mukesh the Merciless and his vile undead horde have been purged from the grounds of Nebo Terrace. The Kurzik homeless are pitching camp there as we speak. Likewise, the Eden thugs led by the notorious and odiferous Smoosh Fatfist have been quashed, making possible the Luxon settlement being built in North Krita Province. By order of the White Mantle, I declare both Nebo Terrace and North Krita Province fit for habitation and trade. Lion Guard Nero. Now, if you haven't visited these settlements yet, take a run out there. Check them out. They're pretty interesting. The Kurzik settlement is actually on top of a hill that was used previously on one of the Christmas quests in Nebo Terrace. And the Luxon settlement is in North Krita Province, just about halfway up between Delesio's seaboard and the northern shore. And I have a feeling that they will be adding a lot more and more to these settlements as time goes by. Now, on to Chapter 2 and what it's all about. Factions takes place in Cantha, the home continent of the sailing merchant's empire, with an Asian theme. The backstory revolves around the antagonist Shiro Tagachi, a former bodyguard of the righteous emperor of Cantha 200 years ago. Shiro murdered his master and was killed for it. But at his death, Shiro Tagachi let out a horrible ghastly wail that turned the seas into solid jade and petrified the forests. And even worse, 200 years after his execution, he returns from his grave to pester the Canthans yet again. It is the task of the players to defeat Shiro ultimately and send him back to his grave for good. If you haven't had a chance to check out the new faction cinematic, I highly recommend doing so to get a better visual understanding of what this story is all about. You can find it on the guildwars.com website, and I'll put a link to it on the show notes for today also. The story also focuses on the two factions known as the Luxon and the Kurzik, who compete with each other for resources in Cantha. And these resources, I assume, are the Jadeite and the Amber that we saw as factions rewards during the preview weekend. Some of the confirmed new cities in Kanta include Altrum Ruins, Amat's Basin, Bai Pasu Reach, Brower Academy, Breaker Hollow, Cavalon, Durheim Archives, Eridan Terrace, Gaila Hatchery, House Zuhelzer, Leviathan Pits, Lutgardus Conservatory, St. Angeka's Shrine, Seafarer's Rest, Tanglewood Copes, the Aureus Mines, Vassburg Armory, and Zos Chivros Channel. I'm sure I pronounced most of those wrong. But I'll now go over some detailed descriptions of the cities as we saw them during the preview weekend. For the Brower Academy, it says, members of House of Brower meet here to gossip, debate, and host celebrations. This Kurzic house is known for its exceptionally gifted sculptors and painters, whose artwork is coveted throughout the world. A favorite Brower pastime, meeting in the courtyard after evening prayers to display their newest pieces d'art. For Cavalon, although Cavalon is the Luxon's home settlement, most prefer to stay on the move, returning only once every decade, when the Convocation brings together all of the three armadas. Traders from around the world come to buy the precious jade and rare seashells that the Luxon merchants sell here. For Eridan Terrace, this remote Luxon post is the site of the Eridan Jade Smasher apparatus, an experimental device of Kanthan design that allows huge chunks of jade to be reduced to smaller size for ease of transport. A small village has sprung up around this structure. For House Zuhelzer, the House Zuhelzer is one of the five great houses of ancient Kurzic families in Kanta. According to the Historian of Houses, members of the House Zuhelzer are the leaders of the Kurzics. Since the Jade Wind passed over the forest 200 years ago, the Zuhelzers have led a renaissance of thought, magic, and art. They are the greatest builders and inventors, enchanting the stone itself with magical words and protections. Their house motto is, "The Mind Conquers All," and their patron god is Duena. For Lutgardus Conservatory, previously known as Cypress Hollow, the Lutgardus House decided to build its cathedral and homes here after the house founder, Lord Rolf Lutgardus, came to the spot seeking guidance from the gods. According to legend, Lord Lutgardus was deep in prayer when a tree, weighed down by its heavy petrified limbs, finally gave way and crashed to the forest floor. It missed Lord Lutgardus by mere inches and was immediately declared a sign from the gods that this was a blessed place to all members of House Lutgardus. For St. Angeka's Shrine, considered sacred ground to the Kurzics, this shrine marks the spot where St. Angeka was struck down by raiding Luxons. Witnesses to the event that day claim that Angeka tried to dissuade the invaders from bloodshed by speaking the glory of the gods, but when a Luxon spear pierced her heart in the middle of her sermon, all hope of peace was shattered. And finally, for Tanglewood Copes, a safe haven for travelers, Tanglewood Copes lies nestled between the outer edges of the southern Kaneng city and the harsh towering Qinkaishi Mountains. According to legend, the first emperor stopped to camp here for the night during his inaugural tour of the Etchevald Forest. It is now a site of pilgrimage for devotees of traditional Kantan ancestor worship. The land of Kanta also brings us 50 new areas and regions. They include the Etchevald Forest region, which encompasses areas like Arborstone, Drazik Thicket, Eternal Grove, Ferndale, Melandru's Hope, Morostov Trail, and Morning Vale Falls. There's also the Jade Sea region, which encompasses areas like Archipelagos, Boreas Seabed, Giala Hatchery, Maishang Hills, Mount Qinkai, Rhea Crater, and Silent Surf. Other regions include the Undercity, the Emperor's Palace, Eternal Grove, Jaya Bluffs, Matu Keep, the Highlands, and Napui Quarters. Factions also introduces us to four new mission types, such as the Challenge Mission, also known as the Cooperative Mission, which involve specific scoring objectives, such as holding out against progressive waves of enemies. You'll see personal bests and high scores displayed within this game. Then there's the Elite Missions, where the most powerful alliances have access to new areas that are designed to be the ultimate cooperative challenge. Then also there's the Competitive Missions, where multiple teams compete to control resource points and achieve strategic victory. Victors earn faction points for their alliance, which will determine the control of towns and outposts. Some examples of these mission towns include Fort Aspenwood, the Jade Quarry, and the Unwaking Waters. And finally, the big one that everyone loved so much last weekend was the Alliance Battles. Alliance Battles are basically large-scale strategic PvP battles that allow factions to conquer new territory. Each faction fields a team of 12, and this team is automatically formed from 12 individuals or groups of up to 4 pre-chosen players in any combination that adds up to 12. The battlefield map varies depending on where the alliance border currently is between the two factions. The more territory one faction has, the harder the map will be for them, with most control points starting closer to the losing faction's team's base. There are usually 7 control points on the map, which are captured by having more players than the other team in the area. Once captured, they spawn a few NPC guards, which count towards holding the control point, and they offer some other special ability, like a melee bonus to people in the arena, elemental protection, spawning resurrection orbs, creating a pet dragon, etc. The NPC guards do not respawn unless the point is lost and then recaptured, so it can be advantageous to kill one, even if it means your character's death. For each control point the faction currently controls, it gains 1 point in short intervals of time. Additionally, each team gets 1 point for each opponent player killed. The first team to 500 points wins the match and gets a bonus 250 faction points. The losing team gets 1 faction point for every point their team has at the end of the game. So it's still possible for you to lose and still gain faction points. And there's no death penalty during alliance battles, and characters are respawned regularly. This makes minion masters and Ai Wei warriors quite powerful, as there are almost always corpses lying around to exploit. And it's very important to spread out and focus on gaining control points versus directly fighting the enemy. A clumped up team has problems winning because they can't easily capture or defend multiple control points. Sometimes it's worth giving up a control point and then recapturing it in order to respawn your NPC guards. A tutorial to the current map is offered by an NPC in the outpost, you should probably be sure to read these instructions before you form a group. Something else to note about alliances in general is that there will be a maximum of 10 guilds allowed in one alliance. Also, a slight twist on the normal mission and bonus system that we're used to in Guild Wars now is the introduction of a third part to each of the 14 new missions, presumably increasing the maximum experience points available in each mission from 2,000 to 3,000. And we already knew that there were new armors, but it's reported that there will be 6 new armors for each of the new and old professions, all featuring an Asian theme. For this skills and build segment, I'm not going to go over a particular skill or build really, but instead I'll go over how the two new classes, the Assassin and the Ritualist, can be used in the game, and what they're good for mostly. I've heard a lot of people just ask, you know, how is an Assassin different from a Ranger Warrior, or how is a Ritualist different from a Monk Necro? So I'll try to explain some of their unique features. First, with the Assassin. All Assassin dagger skills chain into a combo so that certain attacks must follow other attacks. Usually, he must start the attack sequence with a lead attack, and then after that, he can perform an offhand attack, and then after that, he can perform a dual attack. So it goes lead attack, offhand attack, dual attack. If a lead attack is successful, a slash mark will appear on your opponent's health bar. If an offhand attack is successful, a cross mark will appear on your opponent's health bar. And then if a dual attack is successful, a starburst mark will appear on your opponent's health bar. These marks are unique for each assassin, nobody else can see them, and multiple assassins do not interrupt each other's combos. The next attack skill in the sequence must hit before the required mark fades. Each mark lasts about 2 seconds from when it's given. Normal attacks may be used in between without interrupting the attack sequence. Other skills require these marks too. For example, other skills must follow lead attacks or offhand attacks, and an example of that is Blinding Powder. Some skills give marks without following that exact sequence, such as Falling Spider, which is an offhand attack that must hit a knockdown foe, but does not need to follow a lead attack. The Assassin's primary attribute is Critical Strikes, which increases his chance for critical hits and gains energy in return. Then there's also Dagger Mastery, which increases the damage for daggers and linked skills, and it gives a 2% chance to hit twice for each point. Then there's also Deadly Arts for attack and hex skills, and finally Shadow Arts for defensive, stealth, and teleportation skills. And now on to the Ritualist. The Ritualist is basically a shaman, a savage priest of nature that combines aspects of the monk, ranger, and necromancer professions. The specialties of the Ritualist are binding rituals, where they create powerful spirits by binding them with ethereal chains. There's ashes spells, which conjure ghosts by holding the urn with their ashes. And then there's the weapon spells, which improve allies' weapons with magical effects. The area where the Ritualist shines the most, though, is team support, similar to the monk. Although he has some aggressive skills and ways to deal damage, he isn't really suited very well to play solo or even a tank. The Ritualist can be recognized by his typical robes, garnished with bones, teeth, shells, and other objects. Like monks and necromancers, they sometimes wear magical tattoos. Furthermore, Ritualists often go blindfolded in order not to distract their superior spiritual senses with earthly visuals. The primary attribute specific to a Ritualist is spawning power, which can increase the health of all spirits and other created animated creatures. And then there's also channeling magic for lightning and energy-related skills. There's communing to summon spirits, and there's restoration magic for healing, life-stealing, and defense. So that's going to do it for this week's show. I thank everyone for the positive feedback from last week's show, and once I figure an easier yet still cheap way to record Lady Sinea and I again, like that, you'll probably see more of those types of shows in the future. Next week's contest will be on Saturday, April 8th at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's going to be a different kind of contest, something that I really haven't tried before. It's kind of a hide-and-seek idea that I got from someone on one of the forums, actually. And basically, it'll be me hiding in one of the cities on the Tyrion map, in an international district, to make it a little less impossible. And the first person to find me will be the winner. And I think it sounds like, you know, a pretty fairly straightforward idea, but I'll post some details on this in the contest rules section of the website sometime this week. But until next week, spread the good word and tell your friends, tell your guildmates about guildcast.com.